So, I'm here to talk to you today about spectroscopically selected gravitational lenses in particular, which is what I work on for a living. You may have seen a few of them before. These are the most well-known, ones that have gotten the most press. And most of this here is work that's been done with these folks down here at the bottom, three out of the four of them being here in the audience, or at least at the conference. Now, the basic idea, as currently conceived at least, is exactly as Danny was talking about previously. It's a search of potentially lensing objects instead of a search of potentially lensed objects. And it doesn't look great here. This is a typical example of a Sloan image of a luminous red galaxy. And it, you know, the colors are nice, but the resolution's not great. And you certainly wouldn't look at that and say, oh yeah, that's a lens. But the Sloan survey doesn't just take images. It takes spectra as well. And of a red galaxy such as that one, at about redshift 0.3, you have a spectrum more or less looking like that. And most of the time, that's all you have. But every once in a great while, you can imagine that another galaxy kind of sneaks in along the same line of sight. In this case, maybe a blue galaxy at redshift 0.5 or 0.6. It's got emission lines here, oxygen, hydrogen, the usual suspect emission lines. And those get added together, of course, in the spectrum. So what you have is a lower redshift continuum and a higher redshift set of emission lines, which is a bit peculiar but perfectly explainable in terms of these superposed galaxy spectra, and also a fine candidate for gravitational lensing. You have a massive galaxy along the same line of sight to a more distant background galaxy. Of course, data doesn't look that nice. The data has noise, has sky residuals, it has photon noise and whatnot. But you can back out the sort of interesting systems that you want to study just by taking your redshift pipeline. Well, it's not mine. This is David Schlegel's redshift pipeline. Fits these wonderful PCA templates to the data in the course of finding redshifts. And these templates are really a byproduct of the redshift finding, but you can subtract them off from the data and get this residual spectrum, which has got a lot of spikes and wiggles. But then you can do another sort of stylized redshift finding iteration and pick out those emission lines that tell you there's something there at higher redshift. And that's interesting. And you can go take a higher resolution image of something like that, like we do with the ACS on the Hubble Space Telescope, and you can see beautiful examples of gravitational lensing. And if you're still skeptical, you say, maybe that looks like a phason spiral, or I don't know, I just don't believe it yet. You can resort to spatially resolved emission line spectroscopy, which is what you see down here. This is just a residual image, a continuum subtracted image of the, same as the HST data. This is an image in the oxygen 3-5007 line at the redshift of the background galaxy, just coincident with those lensed images. And this is the continuum spectroscopic image. So those are narrowband images. They are constructed out of a spectroscopic data cube. Here's a fairly concise history of spectroscopic lens discovery. It all fits on one slide, and this is that slide. I don't think I've left anything out, but if I have, I certainly apologize. A very well-known lens, 2237, was actually discovered serendipitously in spectroscopic data, as was 0047, which is also pretty well-known, and which gave Warren et al. The idea of actually designing a survey to systematically go out and find these sorts of things. John Willis and Paul Hewitt have certainly done a lot of work on thinking about and proposing those sort of things. This paper here was in particularly thinking about looking for lensed quasars in the 2DF data. And there was actually one lensed quasar to come out of, well, at least one lensed quasar to come out of Sloan from spectroscopic data. That's the 0903 system. And then there is the later Sloan work, SLAX, and also OLS, which I won't touch on because I'm not working on it, but those are the references. This is my basic selection recipe for actually finding these sorts of things. To take luminous red galaxies and main galaxies without strong emission lines, which is to say, without strong emission lines at the redshift of the LRG, to subtract the best fit galaxy template and to require at least three significant higher redshift emission lines in the residual spectrum. And this involves modeling the noise empirically, because you're really fighting night sky residuals and other sorts of artifacts. But it's an automated search at first for these higher redshift emission lines, just a matched filter. And there's the inevitable human step of actually looking at what comes out and throwing a good fraction of it away as crap. But still, in the end, you're left, in the case of the Sloan survey, with about 200 good lens candidates. And depending on how you define good, that number goes up or down by a factor of 100. And so, of note, well, not by a factor, I guess by a term of 100. Of note is that the this criterion of having three emission lines at higher redshift really limits you to source redshifts below 8. So it brings the whole scale of the problem down in redshift with respect to what's usually traditionally seen in quasar lens samples. And we're also sort of working in a limit where the flux of the source is much less than the flux of the lens, which is what lets us find the original redshift and subtract it off, because the first order, the spectrum, is that of the LRG, and it's really just at these emission line wavelengths that there's a contribution from the lensed galaxy. But you can relax the three-line requirement, and we've actually done that with the most recent HST observing cycle. We're getting some higher redshift lenses out of that. Now, the SLAC survey, in particular, this is the sort of associative association of people working on it originally and now the expanded group of people. It's gone over three HST cycles now, starting with snapshot observations and continuing to single orbit and multiple orbit confirmation and follow-up programs. And we've got in excess of 50 newly discovered strong lenses so far. This is, I guess, the pièce de résistance here. This is 42 of the 42 of those 50. These are, I think, about 8x8 arc seconds HST I-band images, just single 7-minute snapshots. They all sort of have some arbitrary scaling applied to put them all on equal footing. One thing you see immediately is that most of the flux is coming from the lens galaxy, not from the lensed galaxy. So if you want to do any lens modeling, you really have to have some good way of subtracting the lens galaxy image, which I'm awful proud of. These are our B-spline models that we use to subtract the lens galaxy, which do much better than you can ever do with a Devokaler or a Sirsik, at least in my experience. So you can see all sorts of different lensing morphologies here. These aren't arranged in any particular order, but you have rings, you have quads, you have doubles, you have some that have multiple sources, really all manner of different kinds of lensing configurations. And you can model these pretty decently with just a singular isothermal ellipsoid and a few parameterized Sirsik components in the source plane, which certainly gives you a good measurement of the Einstein radius, which is the sort of the zeroth order lensing observable that we'll carry forward now, just to give you a little sketch of the distribution of properties of the SLAC sample. Here's the here's how they're distributed in redshift. This is sort of median plus or minus one sigma scatter, intrinsic scatter in the sample. Move right on. So, as has been discussed in Tommaso's talk, and I don't know whether Leon mentioned it or not, but the SLAC galaxies all fall on the fundamental plane with more or less the same relationship defined by local galaxies. This actually doesn't have any luminosity evolution built into it, so I'm just sort of sweeping the constant under the rug. But the sort of relationship between the scaling between velocity dispersion, surface brightness, and effective radius is actually fairly well constrained by the sample now that we have a larger sample than we did in our first round of papers, so we kind of have more leverage on the plane rather than just sort of a line all piled up against the edge of it. There's other sorts of correlations that you can look at. There's the correlation of mass to light with velocity dispersion. This is something that Dennis Zeritsky touched on a couple days ago, and that's also seen by the Soron collaboration in their dynamical study of nearby elliptical galaxies. So that line there is actually their correlation, again, just with the zero point kind of fudged on. Doesn't really seem to be much correlation of mass to light with luminosity, at least assuming I'm computing everything right here. So that's at least as one sort of explanation for how the fundamental plane comes about, doesn't seem to be too strongly suggested by these data. Other sorts of correlations, the Faber-Jackson relation there. Again, that line there isn't a fit, it's just luminosity being proportional to sigma to the fourth. And of course the lensing and stellar velocity dispersions are very strongly correlated with one another. We have a, keep your eye on that little outlier point there. Actually, one thing I don't totally understand is that it looks like luminosity is correlated with sigma, and sigma is correlated with mass to light, but luminosity is not correlated with mass to light. So maybe that's just because the scatter accumulates too much, or who knows. Anyway, I'll sort of revisit the sort of stuff that Leon and Tommaso have been talking about. Now with the larger sample that we have of, this is including 42 lenses instead of the 15 lenses that we had in our previous cycle of papers. And if you just take a rather simple model of the luminosity profile, just a scale-free model, this is something that Leon's published, that's easy to work with because it's analytic, and you compute what the predicted stellar velocity dispersion in the Sloan aperture should be. It's a 3 arc second aperture. You can compare that to the constraint, to what's basically what's predicted by the constraint of the lensing mass, the aperture mass, and the assumed power loss slope that you take for your lens model. So I'm just going to do a sort of poor man's MPEG here. You can see the mass slope there changing and the chi-squared changing. This is between the observed and predicted velocity dispersions. So the best value is still isothermal, or perhaps a little bit slightly steeper. This is, you know, there's that little oddball down there, and that's actually, in some sense, the exception that proves the rule. Both the lensing data and the dynamical data predict a shallower than isothermal mass profile for this particular system here. It's kind of actually the signal to noise is pretty low in this data, so hopefully with deeper observations this will become a little clearer, but you sort of have this small radial arc type thing here. This is actually the isothermal model, so not really the best thing to show, but you have this huge arc and this small counter arc. The point being that we're not really biased. Well, maybe we're biased, but we're not prevented from picking out lenses with any range of mass profiles. We could even pick out lenses with no mass at all, because really all we're selecting for is backlighting by a higher redshift emission line galaxy. We don't really care about the mass profile or whether or not there's lensing at all. If you contend that you already knew that galaxies were isothermal from studies of the local universe, particularly within the effective radius, it's pretty well established in the local universe that elliptical galaxies are more or less isothermal. You can actually use this as a fundamental test of the post-Newtonian parameterization of GR, because really what you have is two different ways of measuring the mass of a galaxy, and then with some scatter quantified by the intrinsic scatter that we see in the local universe. But to go back to the fact that this is a one-to-one ratio here, if you didn't have that factor of two deflection that Einstein predicts over Newton, this wouldn't be a one-to-one ratio. And you can quantify that constraint as we've done here. And so this is a confirmation of the GR value, which is predicted to be 1. So this is like the solar system tests of GR, only on a galactic scale instead of on a solar system scale. There's the reference down there at the bottom. Originally, this was actually conceived as a way of finding higher redshift Lyman alpha galaxies, lensed Lyman alpha galaxies, similar to 0047, which turned out to be a lot more rare than the lower redshift stuff that we've been finding and studying in SLACS. But there are still some Lyman alpha lenses in there. We found a couple now. This is one of them that we've published. This is Keck spectroscopy over here. You can see the emission line on both sides of the galaxy continuum, and then this is a Keck image with various models and residual images there. It's about a 4 arc second separation, not radius, but diameter. So the disadvantage of these kind of surveys is that you really do need to take a lot of spectra. Dedicated surveys for something like this that's only a 1 in 1,000 return is pretty unlikely, I think. So you need a redshift survey or a QSO survey to go along with. And also the traditional sort of imaging preselection of spectroscopic targets can and will eliminate some of the interesting cases. You can think of the case of if the galaxy in the background were bright enough, it would its colors would kick it out of the LRG sample and it would never get targeted by Sloan. And I think these are even more hopeless than source-based lens surveys for cosmological parameters. That's sort of a personal opinion, but I think it could be quantified. The advantage is, though, finish on the good note, the advantage is that it does seem to work really well. And it's an obvious way forward if what we're really interested in is large statistical samples of lenses. And in principle, you can target and study any galaxy population of interest, although obviously it's going to be harder to find tiny spiral galaxies that work really well as lenses. But it can just piggyback onto a larger spectroscopic survey without any really little to no further technical considerations. Another important point is that the lens and redshifts are known, source redshifts are known from the outset. So that helps you with the lens modeling right away. And as I just touched on a little bit earlier, it's less biased than source-based surveys in terms of comparing the population to non-lens galaxy populations. I'll just quickly go over this here. The future, I think, is beyond SDSS is going to take something that's even bigger than that. Higher redshift lenses and sources would certainly be valuable because the entire physical scale of the lensing geometry probes larger physical radii in the lens galaxy and gives you more. It would give you more leverage on the dark matter halos. A sort of future pipe dream would be to have a spatially resolved spectroscopic survey that was magnitude limited and that had a full order n squared redshift finding analysis. If anybody wants to put that together, just let me know. And with enough strongly lensed star forming galaxies, you could think about monitoring for lensed supernovae, which would certainly be really exciting. So I'll just let this slide speak for itself because my time is at an end here. Thank you.
Would your search strategy be sensitive to a background galaxy that is not lens? Say, if you would have an elliptical lens, a red galaxy, which has a flat core and therefore is not producing multiple images, a strong arc, would you find those objects?
Yes, we would. And we don't. As we don't see anything that's at small enough impact parameter is lens within the expectations based on its velocity dispersion or its fundamental plane position. So, yeah, that's I think an interesting observation. One thing we do find is that the mass in the lenticular cases, the mass distribution is noticeably rounder than the light distribution, more so than with the more massive ellipticals. It's really consistent with mass and light having the same axis ratio. But at that lower mass end, which is also the lenticular end. There's that difference. Yeah.
Adam, I know your charge was to speak about the survey, but would you say a few words about my favorite lens in your sample?
Oh, yes. So let me see if I can back up to where it is. I'm going to have to kind of stab at it here. View show. So Paul's... not what I wanted. Okay, Paul's favorite lens, unless it's changed, is this one down here, which in the snapshot data is kind of low signal to noise, but you can qualitatively see what's going on with it, and you can certainly, as far as the lens models go, plausibly see what's going on with it even more clearly. It's an edge-on spiral behind an elliptical galaxy, and you can see the way it traces out here. It looks like one of those resolved micro lensing time series tracing out. You can imagine something going across here, going up and going down, and the counter image appearing, spiraling out, and then going back down into the core. And what's particularly interesting about lenses like that and a few others here where you see images across a range of radii, and not something just like this where you have one at this radius but one at that radius, but you're unconstrained because you really don't have many images. These types of lenses should be pretty well constrained, and they also probe an extended range of radii, so they give you a fair leverage on the radial mass profile just from the lensing data alone, which is something that I've started to look at and hope to make some more sensible progress with. Let's see if I can identify a few more of that. Oh, here's another one up here. You can see you have a ring and a double in the same system. So, yeah, that's one of the particular points of interest among these among this sample, is when you see sort of things like that. Oh, this one here. These are the models. Let's go back to the data.
Just a comment here. And regarding the strange absence of correlation between mass to luminosity versus luminosity that you had at one point, I would like to make a comment that is, even if on the large scale we agree or we find that there is a kind of homology in the self-similar, the isothermal kind of density distribution, this does not guarantee that the virial coefficient is actually constant in those systems. This was shown in a paper that we published 4 years ago with Luca Ciotti and Milena Del Principe.
That's a question of mass homology versus light homology.
So it might be that there is a conspiracy between the mass to luminosity ratio and the virial coefficient changing in such a way that you preserve the matching of the fundamental plane.
I'm just curious about the case you highlighted as being not quite isothermal, which you have up there in sort of the, what is it, third row next to last column?
Yep.
It looks like there's a double image of the lens there, and that second echo ring to the lower left isn't in the model.
Yeah, it does look like that.
I just wondered what was going on there, if you have some feel for that.
I think it's just something else. It almost looks like that was just replicated right over there. So there's always the chance in these circumstances where we're fooling ourselves and lensing is not really what's going on. I know it's not a digital artifact of the readout because the galaxy image that's been subtracted isn't replicated similarly. My sense is that it's at the redshift of the thing in the background, and it's displaced in position and not strongly lensed, and just kind of has a funny similarity in appearance. It is, yeah. It's It's a bit puzzling. We're going to have deeper observations of that, so I think higher signal to noise should, and we'll also have colors. It should help us sort out what's going on there.
With this type of selection criteria, you're choosing a particular source and lens population. Can you do that? Have you found any, for example, spiral galaxy lensing in elliptical, where the spiral is at a lower redshift? Or can you do that for spiral lensing and spiral, where you have two sets of different emission lines?
We have, I think, a couple in here that are spiral bulges, or maybe only one. As far as finding an elliptical galaxy in this one down here, there's fairly extensive spiral structure surrounding this bulge right here. As far as finding lensed elliptical galaxies, wouldn't really work with this technique because you can't really detect faint absorption lines. I guess emission lines can be really bright. Absorption lines, really, there's some limit to their equivalent width that's a lot more modest than the limit on emission lines. So,
Adam, did you try to search for sources which are at two different redshifts to be lensed by one lens?
I think that was also conceivably searched for. If you think about these things as being a 1 in 1,000 phenomenon, then that's going to be a 1 in 1,000,000.
It's going to be hard, but it's going to hopefully break you the Masher degeneracy directly.
Right, so. Certainly. So there's, I'd predict there's an average of one of those in the entire Sloan survey, and it'd be nice to find it. I haven't been looking hard for it. I haven't been not looking for it. I haven't found it. If I do find it, you'll all hear about it.
I'm going to thank our speaker. And our next speaker.